Welcome to We Mentor Mondays podcast with Nancy. Get inspired. Break through to new dimensions with your peers on the entrepreneurial journey of self-discovery. Learn something new from our stories today. Welcome to We Mentor Mondays podcast with Nancy. I'm over at Stephen Berg's Fiber Studio. It's called Stephen B. And he is a fiber artisan that is armed with a wealth of experience, a daring sense of style, and a firm belief in the transformative power of creativity that knitting and crocheting offers to all who are brave enough to push the boundaries. And we are talking about pushing the boundaries of creativity here. Stephen began his career early as a young boy, furiously knitting lines of sequin dresses for a discerning clientele of Barbies in Wisconsin. This naturally led him to become a star student in fashion design at both Parsons and the Fashion Institute of Technology. In our first mentoring session, we learned that Stephen has traveled the world. He's gone to Hong Kong and South Africa to get different types of yarn. And so welcome back to the studio, Stephen. I'm kind of excited to see what we're going to delve into next.
Thank you, Nancy. So glad to be back. And we're in the fiber studio with all the color and texture of wild wool roving and silk pods and all the things that I collect on my journeys around the world. I'm always looking for the newest and the best and the most interesting trends.
Cool. Let's talk about trends. So how has knitting changed from like the 60s, 70s, and 80s, do you think?
Well, oh boy, do I have a lot to say on that. Let me start from the beginning. I think in the past, knitting has always been on a 20-year cycle. It ebbed and flowed. And so I actually have done a talk at the Minnesota Historical Society on the history of knitting and how it wasn't a thing that you did at home in, you know, the early 15, 16, 1700s. It was a job. You were an apprentice. You were a journeyman. You were a master knitter, and you made caps or stockings. And that's how knitting started out. And it was all done in the circle, like I'm doing, with knitting pins.
Oh, yeah.
And it didn't really become a home thing until the Industrial Revolution, when the sock machine came out in started in the 1600s, actually. And then when the Industrial Revolution, Victorian women knit at home then. And they did hairpin lace with crocheting and all these kind of wonderful fiber arts, because it was no longer considered something men did in a factory and produced stockings and caps. No one really knit sweaters back then. And then, you know, actually, the older men did it during the World Wars, and they taught the women in the office buildings, and they knit horrible things like stump covers and for the war victims, and caps and stockings. And I think the 30s and 40s, people knit at home, but it really became popular in the 50s and 60s, except when you learned then, you started on very tiny needles, and you were expected to make yourself a whole knitted suit, a skirt and top. Oh. And if that was true today, I wouldn't have any students. Because we're so much into immediate gratification and seeing results, and I want to start it today and wear it tomorrow.
Yeah.
Although the younger generation is getting a little bit back to heritage. That 50s and 60s and then 70s went into crochet. And that's kind of when I blossomed, late 60s.
Was that when the poncho started?
Ponchos, crocheted ponchos. Oh, my God. I made so many of those for the girls in the neighborhood. Barbie doll clothes, as you mentioned in the opening, that was my thing. And I would get help from my neighbor later. We called her Grandma Erickson, no relation, but she would help me sew on the sequins and the beading and do all the detail. And then I would paint scenes on a cardboard. And my favorite was a skating dress that we made for Barbie. Huh. And it had white Angora trim around the red dress. And then I'd paint vignettes on a cardboard, and I'd go to Woolworths, I think it was.
Yeah.
And buy all the Barbie doll accessories, the shoes and the hat boxes and the
purses.
And then I'd pin them or stitch them all to this cardboard scene, and then I would sell my vignettes. So I had, instead of a lemonade stand, I had a Barbie doll stand.
Oh, That is so clever.
Yeah.
So my mom used to like sew Barbie doll clothes.
I love
like
that.
I had
the
a Barbie
of them.
Yeah, and the right, exactly. Now I remember like my grandmothers would do the they would make these big blankets. So they would have like wooden squares that had these I don't know, steel corner things that would put the corner of the blanket. You would
More sewing.
Yeah, it was more sewing. Yeah.
Because Afghans were the thing in the 70s. Everybody made an Afghan. Everybody made a ripple Afghan. It was usually crocheted. Or you had the fan and feather lace pattern that was knit. And it was just the standard. And it's kind of funny because if you go back, there was like five or six baby sweaters to pick from.
Yeah.
And three or four Afghans. And everybody made the same thing.
Yeah.
And so at that time, when yarn shops started showing up, it initially happened in department stores. So like Dayton Hudson had a yarn department and a fabric department. And it wasn't until the early 70s when yarn shops started opening. So it was a shop specifically to buy yarn. Before that, it was
because it needed to become popular first in these larger stores.
Right.
Before then you could.
And that's when my mother opened in 1971.
Wow. Okay.
And that was, and then it went into the 80s, but early 80s, people stopped knitting so much. It was cool to have a career and a family and juggle both of them, and women started becoming more independent. And I think knitting connotated that at-home personality.
Yeah.
And they were trying to shed that. So knitting took a real hiatus, and yarn shops closed in the 80s dramatically and into the 90s. And then in the early 2000s, knitting came back with a vengeance. And I attribute that to some of the novelty yarns that came out. Everyone that's knit knows of fun fur, and it was a spiky yarn that was colorful and textural, and you didn't have to have much skill. You could know the basic knit stitch, and the yarn did all the work for you. So it got people that had dabbled or mothers had knit back into knitting, and it was all the rage. Mm. And stores like Joann Fabrics and Michaels and Hobby Lobby all came out with all these novelty yarns, as well as the yarn shops did. And I opened my yarn garage in 2003. We started out by doing home parties based on the Tupperware model.
Okay,
and
sure.
So we had antique suitcases, and my sister and I would go into people's homes and have a party, a wine and cheese, a shower, a women's get-together, birthday party, whatever your occasion was, we would come in and set it up. We'd teach everybody to knit. We sold our merchandise right out of the suitcases. And pretty soon we were booked every night and twice every day on the weekend. And my sister, I remember sitting in the SUV, and she started crying and goes, "I don't want to do this anymore. It's not fun." And so we got a storefront then.
Okay.
And that's what, and so we cohabitated with an antique shop in Rosemount, Minnesota for a while, until the owner came to me and said, "You know what? Your yarn's taking over my antique, so we really need to talk." And that's what I do. I take over. I'm bigger than life, personality, and everything I do. I like it to be big and grand and colorful and noticeable. And it's interesting because it goes back to this paper that I wrote. And I'm not sure what grade school year it was, but it was based on the concept that I refuse to live unnoticed and I'll never die forgotten. And that was my, I think it was third or fourth grade.
Really?
Yeah. And so that was always my internal plan.
Yeah. It's a pretty powerful thought at a young age.
Yeah. Huh. I embroidered it onto a piece of burlap even. I still have it.
Oh, wow.
So I got off tangent, but the knitting cycle has, and the enthusiasm has come back as of 2003. And because of the internet, and I think people can say what they want about knitting on the internet. I think some shops don't like it so much, but I think it's just kept it alive. And I think the old days, you would go to a yarn shop, you'd look at a pattern book, and you'd buy yarn for that project, and you'd go home and knit. And then you'd knit after the kids were done, and the dinner was done, and the husband was happy, and you sat down in your easy chair, and you knit. And it was a private thing. And now it's become a social thing with the advent of it in the 80s of the coffee shop that didn't really exist that much before then. And so now you're bombarded with knit images, new yarns, new patterns, new projects every day on the internet, and it keeps it alive.
Well, and people are blogging too.
Blogging, everything you can imagine. It's all about knitting, crocheting, any kind of fiber arts. And it's kept it exciting and innovative, and the whole industry has changed dramatically.
So that's with the millennials, are you thinking? Those who are 20 to 35 now, they've gotten back into it?
They've gotten into it.
There's like 80 million of them.
They're very independent when they do it. They're very independent.
In what way?
They like to shop on their own. They don't like the traditional sales help in the stores, I feel. They're studied before they come in.
Okay.
On what they're planning. They kind of have a different shopping habit than, you know, those that I relate to in your 50s. They also like to experiment on their own, so they'll use YouTube videos and such to try a technique. And they're not so much to follow a pattern exactly. They'll kind of get the gist of it and go off on their own.
Oh.
And so it's a different approach. And the more classic approach, say 40 to 70, is where's the pattern? I want to make it just like the picture. Where's the yarn? And they follow the pattern to the T. And that's what I go around the country talking about, is how to break out of that box that we sometimes put ourselves in. So I have less millennials at my workshops than I do established knitters, because people that I call them the lapsed knitters, the people that took the 80s off and the 90s, and I think there's a lot of them. A lot of people fall into that category. They learned as a young age, or they did it when they had young kids, and then they got away from it.
Oh, sure.
The lapsed knitter have come back to the fold. And so, yeah, I have my Sunday morning knitting workshop. We call it Fiber Temple. So we all come and celebrate fiber and the camaraderie, the fellowship, the therapy that it provides.
Yeah. My husband and daughter, we were here a couple Halloweens ago when you were showing a movie, and we're having popcorn, and everybody was knitting. And, you know, I just love that community that you built here, really provides a strong niche for this area. And I think it's really needed to bring knitting back, but also preserve a culture.
Yes. The social aspect, I think that's a new thing since the early 2000s. In fact, I don't know. I guess my mother had a table in the shop that people gathered around, but I don't think people were encouraged to sit and knit. I think it was more of come and shop, and you went home and knit still in the 80s. And
I think the bookstores and coffee shops have helped kind of nurture that.
We have a lot of groups that meet here. We have a recovering AA group. We have mommies who knit together. Just anything you can think of. Ladies who lunch, just fun groups. We have the nerd knitting night. When I was young and growing up, it wasn't so cool to be a nerd. You know, I was on the nerd list and it was a struggle, but nowadays it's cool. And you've liked that whole, cult following, whether it's Star Wars or Star Trek or Doctor Who or Firefly. We have yarns and projects for all those special interest groups developed.
Tell us a little bit about your brush with Andy Warhol.
Well, let's see. It was, I don't know, 78, 79. I went to Minneapolis College of Art and Design for 2 years. And then I was like, oh, let's blow this pop stand. My friend and I loaded up, it was one of those drive away station wagons. So somebody flew out to the East Coast and we drove their station wagon out for them. And I'll never forget Sunday morning driving into Manhattan. It was like 7 a.m. we got there. And there's this like punk rocker with this huge mohawk stumbling out of a club. And I'm like, yes, we've arrived. And I'm thinking this was so much fun because it was a life I had never lived here in Minneapolis. We got an apartment in the West Village and went to Parsons and FIT. And Andy Warhol lived downstairs and from the unit that we, and it was always like trying to sneak into his parties and going to the Mud Club where Deborah Harry hung out and going to Nancy Sinatra's birthday party at the Underground Club. And so it was like trying to be amongst all these artistic expressionist people that I'd never been part of in Minneapolis. And it was very much part of scene back then. I wanted to be part of it all and be with the bands and the clubs and the personalities and
wanted to be part of the cool crowd. My favorite was Jean-Paul Gaultier, who is my favorite French fashion designer. And I think it was the Tunnel. It was the Tunnel Club in New York on the Lower West Side. And I'm in line to get in and this limo pulls up and the doorman said, I don't know. It's like, what's his name? I don't know. It's the Jean-Paul Gaultier. And I said, oh my God, it's Jean-Paul Gaultier. So I like went and jumped in the limo and I hung out with him all night in the club. And I had just gotten back from Mexico. So I was really tan and he's really white. And I've those pictures from that night. And so it was fun because I went to school with Isaac Mizrahi was in my Parsons class. And, you know, you're always kind of part of that group, and it's just a matter of whose name made it biggest. And I was designing sports clothes, so men's sportswear. And then Marc Jacobs had worked at Perry Ellis after out of college. And then the brand was sold off after Perry Ellis's death, and it remained a designer brand for a while, Michael Kors is today, but then it went off to more of a commercialized brand that went into the lower end department stores. And so that's when they brought me in to try and resurrect it. Munsingwear as well. So yeah, it was living the wildlife, you know, sex, drugs, and rock and roll, baby.
So when did that stop and when did you move into the next phase of your life?
Well, I was corporate and it was interesting because I started out as the women's wear designer at St. Croix Knit, then the men's designer, and then design director for St. Croix Knit. Then I went to Munsingwear as the golf wear designer. And 6 months later, I was head of the department. And then ultimately, when Munsingwear was broken up and sold off in divisions, I went with the sale to a company in Miami called Supreme International, which ultimately became Perry Ellis International. And so I ended up vice president of design and merchandising for that company. And it was a rapid growth, actually, because, I mean, the first phase was 6 years, 6-8 years, and then rapid growth was 6 years. And I found myself in this great position, but I don't think I was personally fulfilled, and it was a struggle for me.
Were you in any close relationship at that time?
No. I'm not a relationship kind of person. I'm independent. If anybody ever called me to ask me when I was coming home for dinner, I'm like, hit the road. Because I don't like to be answering to anyone, and I do what I want. And I don't know, I'm a big person on, you know, I've built my fortunes, I've lost some, it's all for me. And
so you mean as far as like risk-taking, you weren't putting anyone else at risk?
I wasn't, and I did it for myself, and I wanted to experiment, and I didn't want anyone to tell me if I could do it or not.
Yeah.
And I'm very independent, so I guess that comes from my mother's German side. And if I wanted to go out all night, I would, and I don't want to have to answer to anyone, or if I don't want to come home for dinner, if I want to go out to eat. I just too spontaneous.
Okay.
And I can't handle the rules and boundaries. And maybe that's why, I mean, I broke so many rules and boundaries in corporate America, you know, coming to an interview with a lime green suit on in corporate Macy's was just not okay. And I did it anyway. And somehow I was credible enough that I got away with it.
Yeah.
So it kind of, that worked in my favor. I had a great time doing all of that. But since I went off on my own and incorporated, you know, 98 to 2003, it was consulting and a struggle about which works and which doesn't.
Yeah.
And then just doing this, the yarn shop and the fiber studio thing really seemed to work for me. And I kind of got into it thinking, oh, this is an easy job. I could grow old at my rocking chair and die with knitting needles in my hand and be happy. And of course, true to Stephen B. style, it didn't say stay small, and it's just grown, and we've risen dramatically. And so we've got over a certain mark that was my goal, gross revenue for the company, and we've met it. And I didn't think it was possible when I started out.
Oh, and do you think that part of the revenue that you've generated to reach your goal has come from because of online opportunities?
It didn't start that way. I think that the in-store grew rapidly, and then I'm a personality. So I love marketing.
Yeah.
And I've been clever with it. And I think you ask anyone, probably what I'm known most in the industry is my ability to market.
Yeah. Well, and you've got your TV
show. Yeah, TV show, StephenB.TV. And that was done by the people that originally worked on Diners, Drive-Ins, and Dives, and they kind of broke off and were looking for a new fun project. And they came here, one of the ladies knit, and she's, oh my God, we've got to film this. And so we filmed for a year and a half.
Okay.
And then edited it down to 6 episodes.
My favorite, I think, was the glamping.
The glamping, yes.
Camping. Sending us up north. Can't just go camping. You go glamping.
Well, and then you have to know the reality of it. As I got up there and we had to pitch tents and, oh my God, the tents stunk and I had my wardrobe along. And then
at the end of the day, you found your key in your pocket.
They wanted us to overnight there and it seemed like we overnighted, I think, in the episode, but then we didn't because I couldn't stand it. It was like, and they wanted me to sleep on a cot because the tent was too stinky. And then I was supposed to sleep in the cabin in a cot and by the wash machine. And I don't do that.
Yeah, that wasn't your
I don't
thing.
Do that. So I turn around and roll home at midnight. So, is the truth behind the real story.
Okay. So what do you attribute to the spike up in revenue?
Oh, so we started with the store and the retail. And then, I mean, that's changed so dramatically. When you think of, you know, when is the first time you actually ordered something online? You know, it wasn't that long ago, really.
Right, right.
And we were early on in the scene in emails and computerized marketing right away from day one. And we've just gotten better and better at it. And then I bought an entire website revamp from an avid knitter on the West Coast to help me develop it in a really clean, more sophisticated look. And I don't know. The online business has grown. We've doubled this year over last year. And we're continuing to do it. What I don't like about it is so much online is driven by price cutting.
Yeah.
And
your sales. Yeah.
Yeah. And I don't do that. So I haven't gotten into commodity yarn. So if you're going to look up a basic yarn on my website, you're not going to find it because I don't work this hard to make little margin.
Yeah,
I work very hard and curate my collection of merchandise and I customize it to my own taste level and my patterns that I create. So when you're buying something from me, you're buying an artistic piece and a collection of yarns for a project. And I think my clients have come to expect that. And they're buying my tea and coffee as well or anything that or my new book that's out, the Poncini book. And I'm working on project book two now, always coming up with something new. And I think that's where my revenue is growing online.
Yeah.
I also do trade shows. So I do at least 5 to 6 trade shows a year around the country in large cities, New York, Washington, D.C., Houston or Dallas, Fort Worth, Santa Clara, California, New York City. And in addition to those.
Same group of each year?
No, they change. They change. I did Pasadena last year. Ever evolving. And I do the biggest one I do is, most important one. I don't know if it's the biggest, but is in Pittsburgh, the Pittsburgh Knit and Crochet Festival. And I've been with them for many years since I started out and they started out and they've grown to the same level as I have. But I love doing those. It lets me, I got into this because I love being on stage. So, I always wanted to be an actor as a young person, and so I get to do all of it now.
Yeah.
I get to do my art and my personality. And when I go home, I'm really quiet and don't do anything socially, and I stay to myself and ramble around my big old house and wear my amazing clothes, and I'm quite eccentric.
Excellent. Well, thank you for this mentoring session and this wonderful conversation. I think our listeners will really appreciate your history, the background, and kind of how you've built your business in a very uncanny way. And if you're up for it, I'd like to do another mentoring session with you to explore more of the details about how you run your business.
Cool. Sounds great. I think I've only touched the tip of the iceberg.
Good.
Maybe we'll have to come back and do another one next year.
Yes, absolutely. We'll keep in touch. All right. Well, thanks for tuning in, everybody. Thanks, Mike Cabea, our sound engineer and photographer. We'll have some great pictures to accompany our podcast, and we'll see you next Monday.